Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 14, the second of a four-lecture set entitled The Rise of Opera Buffa and Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. We left off preparing ourselves to talk about opera buffa character types and conventions, so please let us do so. Even as it evolved and became more sophisticated, opera buffa continued to use archetypal characters drawn originally from the Italian Commedia dell'arte. Now, the largest and most significant character division in opera buffa, and this betrays its common roots, is between those savvy, street-smart servants and members of the lower class, and, at the other extreme, the blundering, pompous professionals, aristocrats, doctors, lawyers, and merchants. For example, some of the savvy, street-smart, underclass people we meet, well, we've met Serpina in La Serva Padrona. In The Marriage of Figaro, Susanna is such a street-smart servant. Figaro himself is such a street-smart servant. If we were doing Mozart's Così fan tutte, we would meet the servant Despina, who was the oil that certainly lubricates the comedy and the drama in that particular opera, and Leporello does the same in Mozart's Don Giovanni. Blundering, pompous aristocrats, doctors, lawyers, and merchants include, in The Marriage of Figaro, Count Almaviva, Dr. Bartolo, Don Basilio, all of these titled people. One could imagine all of these various degrees and titles after their name, but completely unable to deal with the reality of the real world. Uberto in La Serva Padrona was such a bumbling rich person, and in Don Giovanni, Don Ottavio, and so forth and so on. Look, opera buffa plots, almost by their very nature then, were highly politicized in an era when the relationship between the common, middle, and aristocratic classes was undergoing a profound reexamination. I mean, talk about the right genre of opera at the right time and the right place. No wonder Rousseau was so jazzed about La Serva Padrona. The right kind of music, the right kind of politics, at least Rousseau's kind of politics, all wrapped up in a neat little operatic package. A music, an opera type, made by the Enlightenment, for the Enlightenment, that celebrated common people both dramatically and musically. Très bon, très bon, Mr. Rousseau might say. Now, Mozart's opera buffa, he wrote a few in his youth. Indeed, his first opera, written at the age of 12 in 1768, was an opera buffa, and that is La Finta Semplice, The Pretended Simpleton. His second opera buffa was La Finta Giardiniera, The Pretended Gardener, of 1775, at the age of 19. I would point out that the titles of both of these opera buffa indicate The Pretended Simpleton, The Pretended Gardener. They indicate one of the central plot devices in opera buffa, and that is disguise and mistaken identity. Of course, the big opera buffa, the ones that put Mozart on the map and the ones that can never allow him to be removed from it, are the three opera buffa he did in conjunction with librettist Lorenzo de Ponti. Those operas are The Marriage of Figaro of 1786, when Mozart was 30, Don Giovanni in 1787, and Così fan tutte in 1789. Mozart wrote that one at the age of 33. Look, I've got to mention something about Mozart's age. You know, we say he was 12 years old when he wrote his first opera buffa. He's 30 years old when he does a piece like Marriage of Figaro. With Mozart, I find it wise just to add 20 years. It's easier for us to deal with him, and it's easier for us to absorb the masterwork level of these pieces simply to add 20 years to his age all the time. So we could pretend that he wrote La Finta Semplice not at 12, but at 32. And that's about right. That makes us feel better. It makes us feel better to think that The Marriage of Figaro was written by someone who was 50 and not 30. So let's do that with Mozart. It's very handy, and it makes life easier for us. Let's just pretend he was born 20 years old. And then the age that he was when he wrote these pieces is completely explicable. It's something we can better identify with. Now, briefly but importantly, let's take a quick diversion and talk about Lorenzo de Ponti, this marvelous librettist whose three comic libretti allowed Mozart to really transcend the entire genre with Figaro, Giovanni, and Così Van Tutte. Lorenzo de Ponte was born Emmanuel Conigliano, Jewish, March 1749 in Vittorio Veneto, Italy. At the age of 14, he was converted by his father to Catholicism. Yes, all the Conigliano ragazzi were converted to Catholicism. Their father, who was upwardly mobile and wanted good things for his family, knew that that was the only way his sons would have a chance to be educated, is if they were Catholic. And indeed, the following year, Lorenzo enters the seminary at Ceneda at the age of 15. In 1773, at 24, he is ordained a priest. In 1779, 6 years later, at 30, Lorenzo de Ponte is run out of Venice for adultery. He was one of these creative priests. The priesthood lasted as long as the adultery charges lasted, and that was the end of de Ponte priest. He flees Venice and heads almost straight north to Vienna, where he gets jobs writing poetry and libretti and develops this marvelous, marvelous literary gift very quickly. His first big success is his adaptation of Pierre Beaumarchais' controversial comedy, The Marriage of Figaro, for Mozart, which, according to de Ponte, had been suggested by Mozart. De Ponte was nothing if not a primo uomo himself, very arrogant, very sure of himself. When he gives Mozart credit for anything, which is rare, I believe in de Ponte's memoirs, the name of Mozart is mentioned 4 or 5 times, maybe. So it's unusual for de Ponte to give Mozart credit for anything. And it is significant that he would credit Mozart with having had the idea to do The Marriage of Figaro. In 1792, having made many enemies, by the way, this is the year after Mozart dies, having made many enemies and deeply in debt, de Ponte leaves Vienna quickly, very quickly, and settles ultimately in London, where, among other things, he opens up an Italian language bookstore. In 1805, 13 years later, deeply in debt, one step ahead of his creditors, de Ponte and his family move, we should say flee, to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where, among other things, he opens up a grocery store. The grocery store eventually fails, as did other business ventures in New York and Philadelphia. If de Ponte approached you with a scheme asking for a loan, find a way to say no. It would seem that he had the anti-Midas touch. He turned gold into lead. Anyway, in 1825, 20 years after arriving in the United States, he became professor of Italian language and literature at Columbia College in New York. He helps to build one of the first opera houses in the United States in New York City. And the climax of his life in the United States is the production of Don Giovanni in New York in 1825. He dies in New York City, August 17, 1838, at the age of 89, having outlived Mozart by nearly 47 years. He was a brilliant poet, a brilliant dramatist, among the great librettists in opera history. And really, he ranks with the other three great ones, as far as I'm concerned. We're talking about Metastasio. We're talking about Arrigo Boito, who was Verdi's librettist for Otello and Falstaff, and Hugo Hofmannsthal, who was Strauss's librettist for Elektra and Der Rosenkavalier. All right, back to the Mozart-De Ponte Marriage of Figaro. Some background on the storyline. Now, the characters and the basic storyline of The Marriage of Figaro grow out of two plays by the French dramatist Pierre de Beaumarchais, who lived from 1732 to 1799. These two plays were The Barber of Seville, which was written in 1772, and then the sequel to The Barber of Seville, The Marriage of Figaro, which was written in 1784. Now, more on the political and social implications of these plays in a moment. First, The Barber of Seville, the first of these two plays. The Barber of Seville is a comedy. It contains very little social commentary or anything of that like. And The Barber of Seville has been set twice into an opera, once by Giovanni Paisiello in 1782, and that's a piece that Mozart knew well, and then it was set to a again to become another opera by Gioachino Rossini in 1816. And we will talk about the controversy between the Paisiello claque and the Rossini claque when we get to Rossini's Barber of Seville. The characters we meet in this first play, the important characters are as follows. We meet Count Almaviva. He's about 19 or 20 years old, and he is in love with Rossina. She's about 15 or 16 years old. She is the ward of the evil, blowhard, and pompous Dr. Bartolo. Now, the plot of this first play of The Barber of Seville sees Figaro, a former employee of Count Almaviva, join up with the Count, and together they win Rossina for the Count. There's lots of intrigue, there's lots of disguise and mistaken identity and a shaving scene. I mean, almost all of the stock scenes we'd expect in Commedia dell'arte we're going to get in the course of the play. Now, here's the significant point, and I want you to remember this. At the conclusion of The Barber of Seville, Count Almaviva renounces his feudal droit de seigneur, his right of the master, whereby the lord of each manor was entitled to deflower every maiden in his service on her wedding night. This is a renunciation that the Count is later to regret. All right, the marriage of Figaro is social commentary. Beaumarchais wrote it 12 years later. The action of the marriage of Figaro takes place 3 years after the Barber of Seville has concluded. So we get to re-meet our characters 3 years later, we would hope 3 years wiser. Well, this is what we meet. We have a series of couples, two central couples. Count Almaviva has become, in the last 3 years, a shameless philanderer. Rossina, now the Countess, not 20 years old yet, is old and wise and sad beyond her years. That's couple number one. Couple number two, Figaro, is engaged to Rossina's maid, named Susanna. And of course, Susanna is that lovely young lady with whom Almaviva desperately wants to sleep. He intends to bed her, despite the fact that he has renounced that right by which he might have been allowed to bed her. Then there's a third couple, Marcellina and Bartolo, and a fourth couple, Cherubino and Barbara. We'll meet these other two couples in due time. Now, the action of this second play revolves around Almaviva's determination to sleep with Susanna, and Figaro and Susanna's equal, if not greater, determination to marry before he can force the issue. Joseph Kerman tells us, for Mozart, Figaro was an initiation in theatric sophistication. His librettist was Lorenzo de Ponte, an experienced professional with wit, skill, and polished despair. An operatic version of The Barber of Seville had just made a success in Vienna, a bright, innocent play, innocently composed by Giovanni Paisiello, who was a leading opera buffa composer of the day. But Beaumarchais' sequel, The Marriage of Figaro, was politically and morally so suspect that it could not be staged at all without the sugar coat of music. Opera buffa at that time was gingerly turning towards adult themes, towards libertarianism, towards genuine wit and humanity. Mozart and De Ponte must have half realized that they were creating living comedy out of the traditionally simple farce of Pergolese and Paisiello. Everything about Figaro is exceptional, advanced, brilliant, and alarmingly real. It was much too clever to succeed in Vienna. And as an aside, I would say the reason why it was too clever to succeed in Vienna is if you're going to make fun of aristocrats, the likelihood is the greatest success will not occur where all the aristocrats live. And that was, of course, Vienna. Mozart's sense of cleverness, power, and exhilaration remains an actual aesthetic quality of the piece, a quality that will always fascinate us. Nicely said, Mr. Kerman. Let us move on, please. The politics of The Marriage of Figaro. And, of course, we've already talked about the nature of opera and politics in the 18th century. They are inextricably entwined with one another. Despite the fact that the action ostensibly takes place in Spain, Beaumarchais' play is, of course, a scathing attack on the Ancien Régime, on the French aristocracy as it existed in 1784. The play was initially banned in France, but I would tell you it was unequivocally, permanently, absolutely banned in Austria, it would seem that the Habsburgs had much less a sense of humor than the Bourbon kings did in France about this sort of thing. Napoleon's comment, his famous comment regarding the marriage of Figaro, is absolutely true. Napoleon said, "It is the revolution already in action." Indeed, 5 years before the French Revolution actually takes place, this play is looking very clearly forward towards that revolution. Now, De Ponte's libretto, and they had to get permission. They had to get permission from the censors, De Ponte and Mozart did, to even write this opera. And, of course, the libretto, which was presented to them, was pretty much stripped of the controversial aspects that were in the play. However, and this is the wonderful thing, is Mozart put all of this back in with the music. The aristocrats tend to have pompous and measured music, music that rings of opera seria, music that rings of overblown and false characters. The common characters in this opera tend to have very modern music, very fluid, very real, very natural music. The distinction between the overblown aristocrats and the real, savvy, streetwise common people is highlighted in the music in a way that no one could tell from just reading the libretto. So I would tell you that after this piece was produced, the reaction was, "How did we let this happen?" Well, you couldn't tell until the music was written that this was going to happen. Mozart imbues his characters with an unbelievable degree of life, emotional depth, human legitimacy, and dramatic motivation. No one was ever better, and no one has been better since, in creating real people on the opera stage strictly through music. Now, here's our game plan. To meet the characters, observe the dramatic situation, and finish our all too brief examination of this magnificent opera with the amazing, incredible, awe-inspiring, and breathtaking Act Two finale. My friends, I am going to go to my adjectival palette constantly today. This is a stunning opera, and the Act Two finale is a stunning piece of work. There's no way I'm going to try to put on any, kind of faux, cynical mask of detachment when talking about Mozart. It's a waste of time. This is too good. We've got to wallow in it, and wallow it deserves to be. So, Mozart, De Ponte, The Marriage of Figaro, Act One. The opera opens with a brilliant and bubbling and justly famous overture. Let's listen to the beginning. Oh, it hurts to stop that. I know it does. I know it does. But we must proceed. It's for you to buy the recording and to wallow in this on your own, put it on autoplay, and listen to it 30 times. We never get tired of this music. It's really, really quite extraordinary. Mozart's control of harmony and form is so sophisticated that there's a tremendous sense of forward motion and variety. Yet his melodic surfaces are so accessible and glow so brilliantly that it never loses its popular touch either. We have the perfect combination of great, great musical substance and great beauty at the same time. And often the beautiful face is not also the intelligent face. But in this case, in Mozart's case, it indeed is. By the way, it was Mozart's habit to wait to the very last moment to write his overtures. This wasn't because he was lazy. There was nothing lazy about the man. It's because he felt that he didn't really know what kind of music should start an opera until the opera had gone through rehearsal and he really had a sense of its gestalt, of its essential substance. So it was not unusual for Mozart to write these overtures the night before the premiere, the day before the premiere. I guess he kind of liked the pressure of doing stuff like that. He was a little crazy that way, and of course he had a facility the likes of which no one has ever had before or since. I would tell you, and it breaks my heart to tell you this, because to speak it out loud hurts. Almost the entire Marriage of Figaro was written in 6 weeks from beginning to end. Now, it should have taken a couple of years. Given the amount of music and the quality of the music, it should have taken a couple of years. And most of the opera was written in 6 weeks. That is, from start to finish. Done. That's impossible for me to conceive. It would take a copyist longer simply to copy out the parts than it took Mozart to compose this piece, finished, out of his mind. How he did that, no one knows. It's freaky. He was freaky. The music is amazing. So let's proceed. Again, if we start stacking all this Mozart hyperbole on top of the music itself, this becomes almost superhuman. So let's avoid doing that, because Mozart was a person, and his insight into other people is what this is all about. So let's get some of that insight right away. Number one, we meet Figaro and his bride-to-be, Susanna. By the way, this is what we call a numbers opera, and this is a term I haven't used yet, so I better use it now. Opera bouffe, indeed, even opera serie, are what we call numbers opera. The numbers are the arias, the duets, the trios, and the ensembles. These are the pieces within the opera that have the highest melodic profile. The recitatives are the connectors that connect these numbers together. So if I say that this is number one, it's the first substantial vocal music in the piece, and it is a duet, which tells us right away that we're not going to have that predictable series of arias and recitatives that we would have in an opera seria. Mozart is starting with a group sing, in this case, two people. No formula, that's very important. Everything remains flexible to serve the drama. All right, let me set the scene for you. We meet couple number one, that's Figaro and Susanna. A half-furnished room with a large armchair in the center. Figaro is measuring the floor, and Susanna is trying on a hat in front of the mirror. Usually she's looping some ribbon on it and trying to find just the right lay for the hat. We hear very chipper, upbeat counting music, which sets the scene. Yes, Figaro is measuring the room for the wedding bed, and he's excited about that. Susanna is trying on her wedding bonnet. They are a couple completely at ease with each other, and we will hear that in this duet. They're accustomed to each other's company. They're accustomed to each other's presence. They would seem almost like happily married people already. This upbeat, bouncing number follows effortlessly that wonderful overture. Figaro is counting. Cinque, dieci, venti, five, ten, twenty, thirty, 36, 43, and Susanna's not really listening to him, as married couples tend not to listen to each other. She's just looking at herself in the mirror, saying, oh, now I'm pleased with it, yes. It seems just made for me. Figaro continues, five. And Susanna says, take a look, my dear Figaro. 10. Oh, take a look, Figaro, take a look. 20. Look at my hat now, please. 43. She's getting annoyed. Figaro, take a look, my dear Figaro. Look at my hat now. So finally he stops what he's doing. Yes, sweetheart, it's much prettier. Yes, it seems made for you. Susanna says, take a look. Really, take a look. Yes, yes, sweetheart. Uh-huh, si mio cuore. And Susanna goes back to the mirror. Now I'm pleased with it. Yes, yes. The whole environment here is one of two people who love each other, who've spent a lot of time with each other already, and are very at ease in each other's company. Finally, they sing together. Ah, the wedding morn is nigh. So today's the day of the wedding, huh? Here's another convention of opera buffa. All the action has to take place within a 24-hour period. So it's the wedding day. It's the morning of the wedding day. So they think. How dear to my tender bridegroom is this charming little hat which Susanna made herself. And as they sing together, they sing in what we call thirds and sixths. They sing in intervals that trace these kinds of patterns. And in harmonizing together, the message to us, the audience, is clear. They are of a single mind. They are in complete harmony with each other. Please, let's listen to this opening number. Let's be aware of the casual, easy nature of this music, the wonderful way that they exchange their pleasantries with each other, at first not being aware of each other, but finally singing together and showing us the united front of their relationship. What a fabulous introduction to this couple. We understand the relationship, and we understand much about the individuals, too. And they're people with whom we can immediately identify. I don't think any of us in the audience has trouble seeing parts of ourselves and our loved ones in Figaro and Susanna. All right, a spirited recitative ensues. As Susanna finally notices, she's been so into this hat, she finally notices what Figaro's been doing. Recitative, secco, dry, accompanied by harpsichord only. Susanna says, "What are you measuring, my darling Figaro?" And Figaro says, "I'm seeing if that bed, which the Count is giving us, will look well in this corner." Susanna's alarmed. "In this room?" And Figaro says, "Well, of course the master has generously given it to us." Susanna follows by saying, "Then you may have it all to yourself." Well, what's your objection?" "I have my reasons." "Well, why won't you share them with me?" Yes, Susanna has at once realized Count Almaviva's motive for giving them this particular room, and she'll have nothing to do with it. And I'll tell you that motivation in a moment. But let's continue. Because I don't wish to share it with you. You are my humble servant, aren't you? But I don't understand why you turn up your nose at the most comfortable room in the castle. Because I am Susanna, and you are an idiot. Oh, thank you very much. You're too kind. Now tell me, do you know of any other room to suit us better? Now, right away, Susanna's mercurial temper and quick wit and intelligence are in evidence. She can go around calling anyone she wants an idiot and get away with it, because compared to her, they might be. Look, here's the problem. This lovely, big, wonderful, and spacious room is located exactly between the Countess's bedroom to one side and the Count's bedroom to the other. Now, Figaro figures that this is great because they're right in between the two people they serve. Figaro is now again working for the Count, and Susanna is working for the Countess. But Susanna detects a greater problem here. Anyway, number two, the duet, another duet that immediately follows this recitative, represents at first Figaro's desire to explain to Susanna why this is such an optimum situation. An animated introduction indicates the humdrum activity of number one here gives way to increasing drama. Figaro attempts to explain the advantages of their new bedroom's location. Supposing one night my lady should call you, ting, 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 ting. Why, you could go to her in a trice. Then it may happen that my master wants me, dung, 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 and I'm with him in a hop, skip, and a jump. Now, Susanna responds as if speaking to a child. We realize how savvy she is as she explains to Figaro the facts of life, gently mocking his naivete as she goes. Susanna says, oh, and suppose some morning your precious count, ting, 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 should send you on an errand 3 miles away. Ting, ting, dong, dong. The devil brings him to my door in a hop, skip, and a jump. Now, of course, Figaro is scandalized. He can't believe she's saying this about his count. Susanna, softly, softly, I pray. And then Susanna says, and in, softly, softly, a hop, skip, and a jump. Softly, softly, ting, ting. Softly, softly, dong, dong. Softly, softly. Listen to me, Susanna says. And Figaro says, quickly then, Susanna. If you wish to hear the rest, dismiss your suspicions, which do me wrong. Don't blame the messenger, buddy. I've got nothing to do with this. I'm just telling you what I know. And Figaro says, all right, I must hear the rest, though I am chilled with doubts and suspicions. Yes, Figaro can't believe that his count would have something in for his Susanna. Let's listen to this marvelous duet, and then we'll proceed to find out what Susanna knows and Figaro does not. But first, say acaso madama.
Se acaso madama la notte ti chiama, madama ti chiama, din din, din din, i due passi da quel famoso gire. E poi l'occasione che vuol mi padrone, che vuol mi padrone, don don, don don, i tre salti non vado a sentire.
Oh. I sospetti gelare mi fa.
Mi scacciai i sospetti, i sospetti, i sospetti.
I dubbi sospetti gelare mi fa.
I dubbi sospetti gelare mi fa.
I dubbi sospetti gelare mi fa. Gelare, gelare mi fa.
Oh, poor, poor Figaro. Just when he thought life was about to get easy, his bride-to-be is telling him, not so fast, Buster. Now, is this naive Figaro the clever and street-smart barber of Seville? He's about 30 now, and indeed, it would seem that he's a little slow on the uptake, unwilling to see his master's intrigue at a time when he's looking forward to the slower pace of a happily married life. He is every man, Figaro is. In one writer's words, quote, the first operatic hero with whom a modern audience can naturally identify. And that is utterly true, I believe. All right. Susanna lays it out for Figaro in dry recitative. Now, listen quietly. All right, tell me what's happening. My lord, weary of pursuing beauties from far and near, wishes to try his luck again in the castle. But his appetite is not whetted by his wife, make no mistake. Figaro says, well, who is it then? Well, it's your little Susanna. You? Myself, and he hopes to further his noble plan by having us near him all the time. Bravo! Tell me more. Yes, Figaro's starting to get mad. Hence the gracious concern which he lavishes on you and your bride-to-be. Well, a sprat to catch a mackerel, Susanna says. Hush now, here comes the best part. Don Basilio, my singing teacher, and his factotum, during lessons informs me daily of the Count's desire. So, Basilio is in cahoots with Almaviva, yes, and the barber of Seville. He was the enemy of Almaviva. Figaro, of course, says, who, Basilio? Why, that rogue. And Susanna responds sarcastically, and did you believe that my dowry, which is to be supplied by the Count, that my dowry was the reward for your handsome face? I flattered myself that I deserved it. No, his object is to claim from me those half hours of pleasure which feudal privilege. But what? Has not my lord abolished such rights on his estates? Oh, he regrets it now, it seems, and he's trying to redeem his right through me. Bravo, says Figaro, I like that. How kind of my lord. We'll have some fun out of this. You've found, and as Figaro speaks, we hear a bell ring from the Countess's room. Figaro says, who rang? Why, it's the Countess. Yes, and now Figaro stands informed of Almaviva's intentions. Susanna says, goodbye, goodbye, sweet Figaro. And Figaro says to Susanna, coraggio, mio tesoro, courage, my treasure. And she says, e tu, cervello, use your brains, you big old Gaia. And so she goes off, leaving Figaro by himself. And now, of course, the old Figaro comes out. He will use his brains indeed. In a firm, almost heroic recitative, we witness Figaro's capacity for intrigue reborn before our very eyes. This is not a servant. This is a mensch. Bravo, my master. Now I'm beginning to understand the mystery and see your plan quite plainly. We're off to London, are we? You as ambassador and I as your courier, and Susanna as secret attaché? Non sera. It will not be, says Figaro here and now. Yes, the superior underdog declares a quiet war on his employer. Figaro is determined, although he knows he must proceed quietly and with utmost stealth. We have a marvelous da capo aria, which I'll read through quickly, and then we will listen to. If you wish to dance, se vuol ballare, my dear Count, I'll play the guitar. Oh, yes. And if you'll come to my school, I'll teach you how to scheme. I'll deal with you, but softly. By pretense, I shall be better able to discover every secret. By parrying artfulness with artfulness, now prickling, now fainting jokingly, I shall upset all his intrigues. If you wish to dance, my dear Count, I'll play the guitar. Oh, yes. Now, note the almost pop feel of this aria. It's very direct, immediate, and accessible music. It matches Figaro well. It also matches the dance well. I would point out that the A sections are a galliard, a three-step, and the B section is a duple meter dance. The point is, this is direct and earthy music that echoes a direct and earthy Figaro, now absolutely intent on taking charge of the intrigues that must ultimately lead to his marriage. Please, the recitative and aria, Se vuol ballare.
Bravo, signor padrone, ora incomincio a capire il mistero e a veder schietto tutto il vostro progetto. A Londra è vero, voi ministro, io corriero della Susanna. Segreta ambasciatrice, non sarà, non sarò, Figaro il dice. Se vuol ballare, signor Contino, se vuol ballare, signor Contino, il chitarrino le suonerò, il chitarrino le suonerò, sì, le suonerò, sì, le suonerò. Se vuol venire nella mia scuola, la capriola le insegnerò. Se vuol venire nella mia scuola, la capriola le insegnerò, sì, le insegnerò, sì, le insegnerò. Saprò. Saprò, 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 ma piano, 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 piano. Meglio ogni ancora dissimulando scoprirò tro. L'arte scarmendo, l'arte adoprando, di qua fuggendo, di là scherzando, tutte le mattine rovescerò, rovescerò. Tutte le macchine rovescerò, tutte le macchine rovescerò, tutte le macchine rovescerò, rovescerò, rovescerò. Se vuol ballare, signor Contino, se vuol ballare, signor Contino, il chitarrino le suonerò.
End of scene one. Figaro exits. This, my friends, is trash talk. Travis Bickle, circa 1740. You messing with me? You messing with me? Oh, yes. Figaro is armed and ready to do battle. Let us take a break. When we return, we will meet Bartolo and Marcellina. Thank you. Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 15, the third of a four-lecture set entitled The Rise of Opera Buffa and Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Now, where we have left off is we are in Act 1 of the De Ponte-Mozart Marriage of Figaro, and we've just heard the end of Scene 1. Figaro has decided it's time for him to become the Figaro of old, and he is determined to outfox Count Almaviva, who, he has been informed by Susanna, desires to bed Susanna before her soon and impending wedding with Figaro. So the scene ends with Figaro confidently espousing his conviction that he will outwit the Count on this one. And thus, scene two begins, and we meet another couple. This is couple number three. Couple number one was Figaro and Susanna. Couple number two is the Count and his wife, the Countess. This is couple number three, Dr. Bartolo and Marcellina. Very interesting people, and they stand in stark contrast with the couple number one Susanna and Figaro met in scene one. Bartolo is the former guardian of Rosina, who is now, of course, the Countess. His plans to marry her were squashed by Figaro and Count Almaviva in the Barber of Seville, the action of which took place 3 years ago. Marcellina is Bartolo's former maid. She's about 48 or 50 years old. She has lent Figaro a sizable sum of money, which has now come due. Figaro and Susanna plan to pay back this loan with the money they receive as a dowry from the Count. But Marcellina happens to know that if Susanna spurns the Count, he will withdraw the dowry, and Figaro, unfortunately Figaro, secured the loan by promising to marry Marcellina if he could not pay her back in time. Now, this gets more interesting by the minute, I think. So both Bartolo and Marcellina want to see the impending wedding fail, each for their own reasons. Bartolo out of pure nastiness and revenge, and Marcellina because she's liable to come up with a very young, spry, nimble, and one would hope, virile husband. Now, offstage, before they've entered, Marcellina has just told Bartolo about Figaro's debt. So this is the recitative that begins scene two, Bartolo says. And you wait till the day fixed for the marriage to speak to me of this? Marcellina responds. I'll not lose heart, doctor. To break up a planned marriage at even more advanced stage than this is a mere pretext which has sufficed before now. And besides this contract, he has obligations to me, never fear. But we must frighten Susanna and artfully induce her to refuse the Count. He, out of spite, will take my part, so Figaro shall be my husband, Bartolo responds. Very well, I'll do all I can. Tell me all without reserve. And then he says, aside, I should relish marrying off my former servant, that's Marcellina, to the man who engineered my ward's elopement. Yes, indeed. Vengeance is a dish best served cold. Dr. Bartolo's hatred for Figaro boils over. All right, now please, while I read this, let's realize that the music that Mozart has supplied for Bartolo is pompous, loud, old-style opera seria music. We're going to hear sweeping strings and dotted rhythms, the stuff of the old-style French overture, that music that was used in the French court to welcome the king to the theater, the king being Louis XIV back in the 17th century. So this is music that stinks of age, pomposity of an age that has passed, and Dr. Bartolo, we know right away, is just a big old humbug. Vengeance! Ah, vengeance is a pleasure reserved for the wise. To forget affronts and outrage is ever base and cowardly. With cunning and acumen, with common sense and discretion, it can be satisfied. A difficult matter, but believe me, it shall be done. If I have to turn inside out the legal code, if I have to read the entire index with some ambiguity, some synonym, I'll find a way to confound him. All Seville knows Bartolo. That knave Figaro shall be outwitted. Do we really for a second believe that this blowhard can outfox our Figaro? No. Not for a second do we. And again, I want us to note while we listen to this marvelous comic aria, La Vendetta, the Vendetta, Vengeance, how old and dated and pompous this music is, perfectly suited to this character. This is what I meant before when I said that whatever De Ponte took out by way of offensive characterizations of the wealthier people, Mozart plugs right back in with the music. So let's listen and let's smile. It's most comic and most true to the character. That's marvelous. Now, please notice that Bartolo is a bass, and that's the kind of voice top we would expect for an older man of villainy. It stands counter to Figaro, who is, of course, a tenor, the typical star, the typical hero of an Italian opera. I should add that Susanna is generally a part sung by a lyric soprano, and Rosina, the countess, who we will meet soon enough, is a part generally sung by a more dramatic soprano. But let's move on, please. We have to take a quick break and talk about the archetypes, the character archetypes that De Ponte is drawing on for his characters, really that Beaumarchais is drawing on for his characters here. Now that we've met enough of them, it behooves us to observe the Italian commedia dell'arte archetypes from which the French playwright Beaumarchais, and then, of course, the Italian-born librettist De Ponte, draw their characters. Dr. Bartolo, who we've just heard from, comes from a stock character named Pantalone. He's a rich, miserly old clod. He's a merchant from Venice, always being robbed, always being cuckolded. We never find out, by the way, what he's a doctor of. It's more an officious title than anything else that just shows us that he prides himself as an expert on many things, but really knows very little. Figaro comes from the archetype of Arlecchino, Harlequin, a valet, athletic and graceful, a ladies' man, cunning, claiming noble birth. These, again, are stereotypical characters that if you went to see a commedia dell'arte play and someone was called Pantalone, you would know right away what kind of person, what kind of character they were. If someone was called Arlecchino, you would know what kind of person they were. Well, Bartolo is a Pantalone, and Figaro is an Arlecchino. Rosina in The Barber of Seville is a Colombina. Here in The Marriage of Figaro, Colombina is Susanna. Colombina is a pretty young girl, loved by everybody, though feared for her sharp and acidic tongue and wit. Often the action of the story revolves around her desire to marry. Indeed, the only character regularly involved in opera buffa who does not figure in the cast list of the Commedia dell'arte is the old hag, whether nursemaid confidant or rapacious spinster. And she was a stock character in classical Roman comedy. In The Barber of Seville, the old hag was Berta. And here in The Marriage of Figaro, it is, of course, Marcellina, with all of her desire to marry the young Figaro. All right, following Bartolo's paean to vengeance, Marcellina and Susanna run into each other and indulge in a wonderfully catty recitative and duet. Yes, Marcellina keeps saying, "I will get your Figaro," and Susanna keeps saying, "But your age, your age." And every time Susanna brings up Marcellina's age, Marcellina compresses a little further, kind of like a prune under the midday sun, until finally the victor is clear, and that is Susanna. We move forward to the entrance of Cherubino. Cherubino is a young nobleman, although at the age of 13 we really should call him a young noble boy, who has been sent to court to complete his education. Now, properly named, he is Leon de Astorga, and he lusts after every woman he sees, everywhere, at court, in the fields, everyone. It's said that Beaumarchais created Cherubino out of his own adolescent memories. I think almost every man would create a Cherubino out of his own adolescent memories. And I would add that this part is written for a soprano, a female soprano, not a male soprano, and indeed this part will be sung by a woman in performance today. And that's to indicate that Cherubino, for all of his crazed sexuality, still has not had his voice change. So he is 13 and sounds 13. And again, the part of Cherubino would be most likely sung by a lyric soprano, a soprano with a light and flexible voice. All right, let me read. We're back in Susanna's bedroom, and Cherubino enters. Now, a quick word. A mature, sexually mature male will not generally enter a woman's bedroom that's not his wife. I think I can make that statement with some fair security. But children wander in and out of bedrooms without thinking twice about it, flopping down on the bed or on the floor and twirling their legs and so forth. All right, that's our Cherubino. He's a half man and he's a half boy. And he's used to wandering in wherever he wants. You know, there's that moment at which all of us have to face the facts that we cannot take, if we're a man, our daughter into the men's room with us anymore, and our wives can't take our sons into the women's room anymore. Well, Cherubino would seem not quite to have gotten to that point yet. Anyway, he walks into Susanna's bedroom, plops himself down, and says, "Dear Susanna, is it you?" And Susanna says, "'Tis I. What do you want?" And Cherubino is already waxing. "Oh, my sweetheart, what a misfortune." Susanna, "Your sweetheart? What happened?" And so Cherubino tells Susanna his woes. "Yesterday, because the Count found me alone with Barbarina," that's the daughter of Antonio, the drunken gardener, "yesterday, because the Count found me alone with Barbarina, he decided to send me away. And if my beautiful godmother, the Countess, does not intercede on my behalf, I shall go away and never see you again, my dear Susanna." Of course, Susanna says, "You won't see me again? Bravo! Too bad! But does your heart sigh no more in secret for the Countess?" Yes, the Countess. Cherubino's face flames. "Ah, she inspires me with too much respect. Happy you, you who can see her when you wish. You dress her in the morning, help her to undress at night.